Hi, Ken here. At unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. So we can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Mahayana Mind Training, Part 2.
Good morning. So today we start into the instruction for Mahayana Mind Training. And this morning, I want to cover three topics. Where this teaching comes from. Why do we do it? And then the first of the 7 points, which is groundwork. This may not be a completely logical talk, because there are various themes and ideas that I want to interweave into our discussions, which I hope will help you to understand and possibly clarify what one is actually doing in practicing, Buddhism, and practicing meditation. Because I find there's actually quite a lot of confusion about that. We're here for the next 5 days. We'll have a total of 8 teaching periods. So today and the next few days, 2 periods a day. We found that it's best not to have another teaching period on Sunday morning because people are like, can't take any more in by that point. So we give you a break. And just allow that time for everything to consolidate. It's not a lot of time to cover all of the aspects of mind training. Probably not possible to cover all of the aspects in this period of time, but we can make a good start. And I think a good place to start is with the source of where does this teaching come from. Now, even with this, we start right into what I think is a very significant difference between the way that we regard education, learning, and training in our culture, and the way that learning and education, training was done in other cultures, notably Tibetan culture, which pretty well didn't change changed very, very little from well, certainly 1100, but probably as far back as 800, until the 20th century when the Chinese invaded. And none of us have the experience of living in a culture which doesn't change appreciably for 1,000 years. It is far easier for me to read a Tibetan text that was written in 800 or 900 A.D. than it is for me to read a text in English, such as Beowulf or Canterbury Tales in its original form, which is extremely difficult. Actually, you really have to learn Old English in order to be able to read that. But many of the texts that we study go back 1,000 years, and they're easy to read. That's how little change there was. There are a few other things that come up here. In Kongtrul, in writing his biography, his commentary on the 7 points of mind training, often copied almost verbatim what Chikawa had said in the 12th century. Today that would be and without any attribution or acknowledgement, today that would be regarded as plagiarism. It gets worse than that. Ingrid, my ex-wife, has been engaged in translating an encyclopedia that Kongtrul wrote, and she found that whole sections of the Dzogchen teachings were literally word for word repetitions of stuff that Longchenpa had written in the, Longchenpa would be 13th, 14th century, like 500, 600 years earlier. Again, without any attribution whatsoever. So this is an example of the difference between the way that we regard education, training, and learning and the way they did. There's no question of plagiarism. The reason was that in traditional cultures, one's development as a human being, development of your potential, was based on the emulation of past examples of perfection. So you always look to the past and say, how did they do it? And then you try to do it that way. Whereas in our culture, our basis for developing our potential is individual exploration and experimentation, and finding out what works for us. So it's a constant experimentation going on, and it's very much future-oriented. And the reason I want to I bring this up, and some of you have heard me talk about this before, it is this difference in perspective, looking to the past, looking to the future, that is at the basis of much of the conflict that is experienced in the world today, significantly between modernist and fundamentalist approaches. Fundamentalist primarily looks to the past. Modernist looks to the future. And these are very, very different perspectives and to some extent irreconcilable. So if somebody had said it well before, you didn't try to say it any better. You just took what they said. They'd said it well. That's it. And it's, but if somebody takes, if we write something and it's well written and somebody takes it and just puts it in their book, then we file a lawsuit saying you copied us. and we don't usually take it as a compliment. We take it as theft. So we're going to find that again and again as we go through this. This is very much building on what people in earlier times had done. Now, mind training, as I mentioned last night, is a very broad category of teaching. And covers virtually every aspect of Mahayana. There's mind training on every aspect of Mahayana, somewhere or other. I have a book back in Los Angeles called The 100,000 Collections, 100,000 teachings on mind training. And I don't think there are 100,000, but that was just the, you know, title they would give to these collections, the 100,000 of this, the 100,000 of that. But there's dozens, if not hundreds. And some have come down, some have proved to have been easier or more useful, more effective than others. And one of those is mind training in 7 points. You have mind training in 37 points, which I think goes back to Dharmakirti himself. You have the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, which is a mind training text. You have the Mind Training in 8 Verses by Langri Tangpa, and so forth. So we've got all of these mind training teachings. But this is mind training in 7 points. Now, all of these mind training teachings trace their origin back to Atisha. Atisha was a great Indian teacher who committed a no-no. He was probably comparable to the Pope of Indian Buddhism. That is, he was the holder of the seat at Bodh Gaya, which is where Buddha attained enlightenment, and it's probably the central Buddhist pilgrimage place in India. But he held the seat at Bodh Gaya, and there was a big prayer festival and people from all over the place. And in Atisha's tent, this Vajrayana practitioner appeared, Maitrepa, making love with his consort. And this outraged the monks. It's totally inappropriate. I mean, indecent behavior. We have laws against these things, even today. And some of the senior monks looked at Atisha with, do we throw him out? And Atisha didn't say anything. And the monks took that as a yes. So they went over to Maitrepa and seized him and started to move him to the exit, throw him out of the tent. And Maitrepa wrestled himself loose and said, if I'm going to leave here, I'm going to leave in my own way. And he walked straight through the wall of the tent. History doesn't record what happened. Maybe she went with him. I don't know. Ask Maitrepa. Which point Atisha said to himself, uh-oh. Now, Atisha had had an intimate relationship with Green Tara from the time that he was 8 years old. Anytime he prayed to Green Tara, she just appeared. So he went back to his own personal tent that evening and prayed to Green Tara, and nothing happened. And Atisha went, uh-oh. So he really started pouring his energy into prayer, and Green Tara eventually appeared with her back turned to him. This had never happened before. And Atisha went, I did something wrong today, didn't I? And Green Tara went, yep. What's the karmic result? You're going to be born as a worm which goes around the base of Mount Meru 7 times, and every day birds are going to come and peck at your flesh until you're just skin and bones. And then the next day you'll be another worm again, and that's going to happen for several centuries. Said Atisha. Not good. Is there an alternative? Green Tara said, yes, you can go and teach the Dharma in Tibet. Atisha said, I'll take the worm. But shortly after, Rinchen Zongpo, who had been sent to India by the kings of Western Tibet, prevailed upon him to come And in 1042, Atisha came to Tibet and was one of the people who revitalized Tibet after a couple of hundred years of, revitalized Buddhism in Tibet after a couple of hundred years of persecution. Atisha himself had received these mind training teachings, again, as I think I mentioned yesterday, from Dharmakirti in Sumatra. Atisha had been given many, many indications that the essence of Buddhist practice was bodhicitta, awakening mind, which is the union of compassion and emptiness. And Atisha must have been quite a stubborn guy because he kept having to get reminders of this. Like he'd be at Bodh Gaya and one statue would turn to another and say, "What's the most important teaching in Buddhism?" And the other statue would say, "Bodhicitta, it's really important." And after about four or five of these, Atisha got the message. And that's when he started his studies of bodhicitta itself. He came to Tibet and established refuge, the vow of refuge, as the basis for practice, and taught widely, very highly regarded, and laid the foundation of what became the Kadampa tradition. And wrote the first of a genre of literature, the Lamrim, or sequential path, which just set out the stages of practice, of what were the meditations to do. That's been translated into English. I think it's called The Torch of the Path or something like that. One of the more better known Lamrims in the West is Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which was written several hundred years later. There's big ones like Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chemo, which is huge, very, very detailed. And but even my book, Wake Up to Your Life, is a kind of Lamrim because it leads one through a sequence of practices. So this is a very basic genre which started with Atisha. Atisha had received the teachings on taking and sending and mind training from Dharmakirti. And they were under seal. And what that means is conditions for seals were varied, but in this particular case, it meant that this teaching could only be transmitted to one student in each generation. So Atisha transmitted it to Drompton and Drompton to Bodhwa and so forth. And that lasted for about seven generations, and then the seal was broken, and it was widely disseminated. But it was a very secret teaching, which today, you know, why? I mean, why do you keep the secret? Part of the reason, again, comes from the traditional way of looking at things, that these were very deep methods of practice, and only those who had shown themselves to be truly capable of practicing were actually given them. They weren't given to everybody, but only those who could really use them and would really use them. And second, it's a way of preserving the power and energy in the teachings is to restrict it. This is totally contrary to how we approach education and teaching and learning, where we just make everything available and people pick up what's useful to them and work with it and so forth and so forth. So, 800-900 years ago in Tibet, if you wanted this mind training teaching, you would have been very, very hard pressed to get it. And it was not easy at all. If you went into the monasteries, you would have studied logic and practiced morality and maybe given some basic meditation instruction. And only if you displayed any particular ability would you have been given any other teaching. It's a very, very different climate from what we, from our own practice. Then if you, I don't know if you have the chant booklets here, but the prayer that we read this morning, Soothing the Pain of Faith. This prayer was written by Congtrul and traces the lineage of mind training. And you can see in the third stanza, Dharmakirti and Lord Atisha. Tracing it back further than that, it's a little dubious. There is the Tibetan and the Zen lineage or traditions had two very different ways of establishing lineages right back to Buddha. In the Tibetan tradition, where there were gaps, they made people live arbitrarily long lives to fill in the gaps. In the Zen tradition, they just filled it up with a bunch of completely made-up names. What was very important was to establish it back. And it's a rather interesting thing, because there's a very mixed message in lineage. One is, in keeping with the traditional way of looking at things, says that that's the emulation of past perfection. Well, this person practiced, and then this person practiced, and this person practiced, so you do it just this way, and you have the feeling that everything's being handed down to you, and this is what it is. And there's a lot of truth in that, very definitely. But there's also another message in tradition, which a friend of mine pointed out to me, and said, if you're dependent upon that transmission, the implicit message is what was discovered once cannot be discovered again. And this is just not true. We can all discover truth of our own nature and what we are, and the only place we can discover it is our own experience. So we have these two themes going back and forth. One, the quality of transmission, where there is some kind of understanding, some kind of knowing, which can be transmitted in the sense of elicited or awakened by the teacher in the student in each generation. And that's been very, very important in Buddhism. And then there's also the possibility of discovering it. And Buddhism actually has been pretty successful in keeping both of those things awake and alive. In many traditions, only what has been transmitted that's valid, what is discovered in each generation is regarded as not being so valid. And in others, you know, the tradition doesn't matter or what was discovered in the past. It's only what you come through your own experience. And there are weaknesses in both of those. But Buddhism, for some reason, has been able to keep both of those together, though it's sometimes been an uneasy tension. There'll be more of that later. Then it follows down the Kadampa tradition and through all of these names, and you'll see in the third verse the mention of Chikawa, who is basically a fourth generation after Atisha. And if you go on to page 6, you see it goes down to Tome Zongpo in the second line. Basically, was more or less the end of the Kadampa tradition. Then it gets starts to follow very different lineage, and the lineage it's following here is the Jonangpa and the Shangpa transmissions. Taranatha was one of the great Jonangpa and Shangpa masters, and became a very, in the tradition which I received from Kala Rinpoche, became a very fragile line of transmission carried through the Shangpa. And then you get down to teachers in the 18th and 19th century in the third stanza there. Lodra Thai is another name for Jamgon Kongtrul, who was the author of this, one of the great teachers of the 19th century, and had a tremendous influence on the revitalization of Buddhism in eastern Tibet. And then in the following stanza, it comes down through the Kamakaju and Champa lineage holders. Norbu Dundrup was Kala Rinpoche's teacher. Rongchung Kunchap is Kala Rinpoche's formal name. It means self-arising, all-pervading. And so down to the present day. So that's where these teachings come from. And they've been practiced successfully by every generation of teachers. Chekawa was an extraordinary person. He basically knew all the Buddhist scriptures in Tibetan Buddhism by heart, which is comparable to probably memorizing 10 or 12 Bibles, at least. And so you could just ask him a line and he would be able to tell you chapter and verse where it came from. One of my teachers, Dajin Rinpoche, who died a few years ago, was the last person who had anything close to that. And he was almost the same. You could say, I heard this line. He would go, that's probably from this text. It's phenomenal. And Chikawa practiced a lot of different teachings, but it's very clear from the way he writes that the mind training teachings, the mind training in 7 points, was something that's very, very close to his heart. And he just took all of these teachings that he learned from Atisha, from that transmission, and summarized them in these seven points. I've received this from a number of teachers, principally from Kala Rinpoche, but also from Khamtra Rinpoche, Dajin Rinpoche. Had a very interesting discussion about this with Tralek Rinpoche. It's been a very important practice for me, as I mentioned yesterday. The nice thing about taking sending, as Khamtra points out, is it doesn't matter how well you are doing or how horribly you're doing in your life, you can always practice taking and sending. Totally independent of what you're experiencing. So you can use it anytime, anywhere. What's that they're saying about media these days? You can watch it when you want it, what you want, how you want. Well, taking and sending is kind of like that. Now, why is mind training and taking and sending particularly important? Why do we do this? This is potentially quite a deep discussion. As Joseph Goldstein points out in one of his books, and this is certainly the theme throughout Buddhism, we don't do anything because we're comfortable. We only do something because we are uncomfortable. And we find this in the Four Noble Truths. What motivated Buddha Shakyamuni was the observation that life is suffering, or there is suffering in life. There's this struggle that we have. And that struggle, we find ourselves struggling with life. Some of us find ourselves struggling horribly with life, and some it's just a niggling inconvenience, but it does produce this sense of struggle or dissatisfaction or something. That is always the basis for practice, because that struggle makes us curious. Like, what does it have to be this way? And is there an alternative? Is there another way of living? And out of that curiosity, humankind has come up with all kinds of things. You know, the desire for eternal peace, the desire for eternal life, eternal bliss, universal selfhood, all of these spiritual longings. But and they sound wonderful, and they're all myths. The fact is that here we are, we experience having a body, we experience going through our life. How do we do this without struggling? That's the core question, and one that has been the subject of inquiry for centuries. It's certainly what motivated Buddha Shakyamuni or Gautama, the prince, and motivated him to leave the life of a prince behind, because he saw that that wasn't the answer. And then he tried, you know, starving himself, you know, living a life of complete simplicity, and that wasn't the answer. And what he came to is that that all we can do in this life is develop the ability to experience whatever arises. Then we are at peace. So, taking and sending and mind training, I'm going to say a word a bit about the term mind training, is a way of refining the way that we experience things. Now, it's come into English as mind training, and back when all of us were learning Tibetan, we had this term lo jong. Lo is the word for mind or attitude, and jong is the word to train. It also has a lot of meanings, but somewhere along the line I realized that in probably the better translation for this is refining rather than training. And it was with some amusement that I came across Uchiyama's book, which has now been retitled for the third time, How to Cook Your Life. But its original title was Refining Your Life. And it's a very good book, so I recommend it. And fits very well with mind training. So rather than think about this as training you to think a certain way or to experience things a certain way, think about it as refining how you experience the world. Now, that's very important, because when we think about training, you know, that's what we do with animals. We train them, and we train people to do things. And there is a sense of making them into something that they aren't already in training. Whereas refining has a very, very different meaning. You take a piece of what looks like rock and you pound it into bits, and you mix it with acid, and stuff dissolves, and you pour that stuff off, and then you heat it up, and you burn more stuff off, and what are you left with? Pure gold. But that gold was always there. It wasn't brought into being by the process. You refined the ore until the gold revealed itself. And that's a really good way to approach practice in general, and particularly the teachings we're going to be working with over these few days, that this isn't about making us into something that we aren't already, but working with our experience so that the stuff that gets in the way of experiencing things just as they are falls away, and now we have the pure gold of our actual experience. And that's actually quite different from the way that we ordinarily experience things. So probably should be retitled Mind Refining. It doesn't work in English as well because it's that extra syllable, but we'll work on it. Now, it's probably a good idea to have some idea of what does the gold look like? You know, you can do things to this rock, but you don't know whether you're going in the right direction. And here we find a phrase that my teacher liked to use all the time. Tong ni ningje ningpo chen. Tong ni is the word for emptiness in Tibetan. Ningje is the word for compassion. And ningpo is the word for heart in the sense of core or pith. And chen is to have. So to have the essence, which is compassion and emptiness. That's the pure gold. Now, the last few years, my understanding of this has shifted a bit, or understanding, maybe appreciation would be the better word. And this came through three or four different lines of influence. But the essence is that what I'll call empty compassion is the definitive spiritual quality. And I say empty compassion, maybe we can come up with a better term than that. To distinguish it from compassion as an emotion. Compassion as an emotion is very important, of course, but it is still based in a sense of I, other. Empty compassion is not based in a sense of I, other, and it's probably not correct to call it an emotion because it is a quality of experience, a quality of awareness. And it's difficult to match up English and Tibetan terms, but there's a clarity and a naturalness to it which takes it beyond what we ordinarily think of as emotion. Because that empty compassion is simultaneously a knowing. And it's a knowing which does not depend on conceptual processes. Now, I think it is highly likely that everybody in this room has experienced this. I would actually be a little surprised if there was a person here who hadn't experienced this. You may not recognize it as such. So let me give you a couple of examples, or one example anyway, which is quite common. A friend comes to you, a good friend, maybe a very close friend, maybe someone in your family, so they may be, and they've experienced something really difficult in their lives. They got fired from a job. Maybe a child has died. Maybe they've realized their marriage is over. Maybe they've been diagnosed with a terminal illness. You know, something really, really difficult. And for whatever reason, you immediately sense there's absolutely nothing to do in terms of recommending remedies and saying, well, you do this and this and this. It's not about making them feel better or taking care of them, etc. It's just about being with them. And so you're there. But in that being there, it's a there's a kind of openness, and you don't know where the words come from, but the words come. Or maybe you don't know where the silence comes from, but the silence comes. And there's something very profound and immediate and at the same time completely natural. Anybody experience this? I think all of you know what I'm talking about. Okay. That's what I mean by empty compassion. You don't think of yourself as feeling compassion for them, but in a very, I would say, in a visceral sense, that is the quality that is being, that is present. Now, I think it's very worthwhile examining this experience carefully. Because when we do, we'll see that there are a couple of characteristics. In such moments, we're not conscious of ourselves. We're not thinking in terms of I. Yet we are completely responsive in the situation. Now, from our conventional way of thinking, that is completely paradoxical. You know, I'm meant to be in control, but here there is no I, and the right things are happening. It's very disturbing to the sense of I, but it, at the same time, it's completely natural. Another characteristic is there's a timelessness to that experience. You can be with that person and there isn't a sense of time passing. There isn't a sense of time. There also isn't a sense of limit. One feels open, but there isn't any limit. You could almost say there isn't any boundary, but it's not in the unhealthy sense. So, by looking at it this way, maybe you get an idea of why I'm using the term empty compassion, because there's a quality of emptiness of being nothing there, while at the same time the quality of everything being there. And the compassion refers to the extraordinary sensitivity and responsiveness that is present. Now, what would it be like to live like that all the time? I mean, we need to take a look at that. I imagine the thoughts that arose in some of you is, that's not possible. But is that true? There is a responsiveness in that experience to the needs of the moment. Or, to use a phrase from Uchiyama, a responsiveness to the direction of the present. So it's not like things that need to be done don't get done. They do get done. But they don't get done the way that we ordinarily go about doing things. I'd like to venture the notion that actually it is possible to live like that. And some of you would be going like, ah, I wouldn't be in control. Yes. You wouldn't be there at all. And of course, that's a little challenging for some of us. But I ask you this question. If you did live like that, would there be any sense of struggle in your life? Would you have any regret about anything that you did? Alex, isn't it? Use the microphone, please. Is it turned on? Okay.
Is this working? You have to turn it on all the way over. There's two clicks.
No? Is that working? When things get complicated and you need to think things through in order to make the right decision, you need a model for what's going on. You need a model of yourself as well. It seems like it's almost the same thing as this sense of self.
When things get complicated, you need to think things through.
To make the right choice.
Yeah, I know. I want to throw out another idea here. The illusion of choice is an indication of a lack of freedom. You want to chew on that one a little bit? The illusion of choice is an indication of the lack of freedom. I got it from somebody recently, and I can't remember who. I remember talking about this with Michael Conklin up in Portland, but so it was a while ago. But I can't remember where I came across it. No. Trump could have come up with it, but no, it's his was, we have to get over our preoccupation with the illusion of accident. But when we see really clearly, we know. Now, most of the time, I grant you, we don't see that clearly, and thus we have to think things through. And it's how we actually get to the point of being able to see things clearly. But when we really see things clearly, then we just know. I'm not going to pretend that living this way is easy, that developing the abilities to live this way is easy. It's not. But I just want to raise the question. You want to continue?
Yeah, it seems to me that there are situations where you have to engage your intellect in order to make the right decision. There's no ethical dimension to a game of chess, for instance, but you're not going to see clearly unless you.
How many chess masters have you talked with?
None.
You might find it very interesting. I was reading about Casablanca. Casablanca, who is a Cuban chess master, early part of the 20th, maybe in the latter part of the 19th, anyway, quite a long time ago. But like a lot of chess masters, they would play 30 games simultaneously. Some of them could play 30 games blindfolded simultaneously. They just saw. And that was the only way they could do it. And what I want you to consider is, how many times do you actually think through a problem? My own experience here is that I relatively rarely think through a problem. I will think about a problem a great deal. I will think about it and think about it and think about it. And I very, very rarely come up with a solution when I'm thinking about it. The solution comes usually when I'm not thinking about it, when I'm doing something completely different, often something that's relaxing, and I'll just go, oh, that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, the solution comes that way.
Yeah.
But then you have to see the consequences of it. I mean, if you read a game of chess, then they go through all these different lines.
Yeah.
And so an idea will come to you, and then you need to decide, well, if I do this, what's going to happen?
What I want to point here is the process of thinking about it and thinking about it is actually a way of connecting with the problem. When you really connect with the problem, that there is no separation, that's what we're talking about here, then the problem tells you what the solution is. And afterwards, then you go and check it out, yes. But the actual knowing comes because there is no separation. And what I just want to raise as a possibility the notion of actually having that degree of awareness so that you don't experience separation, so whatever arises, you know, just like that. So we'll explore that this weekend, okay? Now, I've got a few minutes left. What I've been covering here is the reason why we do this practice. It's a way of refining our experience so that we become empty compassion, which is, that is the gold that we are already. If you want to refer to that as Buddha nature, it's fine. Right now, we're pretty unrefined hunks of gold ore. You may doubt that you have any gold in you, you do, and you're just going to have to live with that. So let's turn a little bit to groundwork, which is the first of the 7 points. Now, I chose to use the term groundwork because I just hated this term preliminary practices. In the Tibetan, it's ngundro. Ngun is the word for before, and dro is the word to go. So what goes before? So preliminary practices or preparations seem entirely suitable. And what I found consistently is that everybody wants to skip over them. Oh, these are the preliminaries. Let's get to the real stuff. And and what people find, and we find over and over again, is that almost all of the difficulties that we encounter in our practice is because we don't do the preliminary stuff thoroughly enough, don't do enough groundwork. And so I thought, okay, can we come up with another word in English? And I can't remember how I came across groundwork, maybe in a thesaurus or something. thought, you know, well, this certainly makes it much more important. You know, you can't do something unless you've done the groundwork for it, because you just don't have any basis to build on. So I think it's possibly a useful way of thinking about things. Now, in traditional teaching, groundwork takes certain forms. Many of you are familiar with precious human birth, death and impermanence, shortcomings of samsara, and working of karma. And these are regarded as the preliminary practices or the groundwork. But I want to say a couple of words about why. Taranatha, in one of his commentaries, didn't put a lot of explanation into the precious human birth because he regarded it as a special case of impermanence. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of impermanence first. Impermanence is the contemplation or the idea which cuts through our addiction or indoctrination, maybe the better term, that the world of society is the real world. One of the things that I think is partially, maybe a lot more than partially, responsible for so much of the suffering and conflict we experience is the evaporation of any sense of an interior life. There is only the life of relationship and trading and sharing and accomplishing and doing these things. What death and impermanence do as meditations is they put very starkly in front of you the fact that what we experience now is our life and our life alone. It isn't anybody else's. We're born into this world alone. We leave this world alone. We have the illusion of being with other people while we're here. Again, Trichiano puts it, this is a completely, as he says in so many words, this is a completely inaccurate way of looking at things. But it is more accurate, he says, when we are born, the world of our experience is born with us. And when we die, the world of experience dies with us. This is the world in which we actually live. The world of our experience is the world of experience in our world. The world of our experience is the world that we construct within the world of our actual experience. And then when we take the world we construct it as being what is real. This is fundamental to our lives. Death and impermanence points this out to us. And then what does how do we live in that world? Well, this is where we turn into the subject of karma. What we actually experience is shaped, influenced by everything that we think, say, and do. From the earliest moments in our lives, what we think, say, and do determines how we experience things. And so how we think, or what we think, what we say, what we do, become very, very important. And that's basically what karma is pointing to. It's not, in my mind, about past or future lives. You can go into that if you want. It's understanding that there's an ongoing process of evolution in our experience, and that what we put into that experience initiates a process of evolution which results in an experienced result, how we experience things. And so we need to pay very careful attention to what we actually do. There's an old story, Native American Indian, of a elder speaking with a young warrior who's causing a certain amount of trouble in the tribe. And the elder goes for a walk with this young man. And the elder says, "I'm very troubled." And the young warrior thinks he's going to be talking, he's going to admonish him, gets all defensive. The warrior says, no, this is not about you. I'm very worried about me." And this stops the young warrior and says, what are you worried about?" He says, I have two wolves inside me. And one will do a lot of harm, and one will do a lot of good. And they're fighting. And I'm worried about what the outcome is going to be." Now the young warrior is completely involved in this as well. What's going to happen? Who's going to win? And the elder turns to the young warrior and says, "The one that I feed." And where we put our energy, what we put our energy into, is what actually shapes what we experience. And that's essentially what karma is talking about. And then the shortcomings of samsara flows right out of this and basically says, very simply, if you put your energy into opposing, you will experience hell. If you put your energy into trying to get things, you will experience poverty, hungry ghost realm, and so forth, through all the six realms. In other words, any time you put energy into reactive emotions, emotions that are organized around a sense of self, you are creating the circumstances in which you will suffer, just through the process of the evolution of the actions. And you will never find any happiness there. And that's true. You never find any peace because you just keep spinning things around. Groundwork consists in taking these loop back to the precious human birth. It's very rare that we actually have the opportunity to be able to do anything about any of this. Most of the time, all of us are just caught up in the frenzy and busyness of life. Here we have 30 people who have stepped out of the frenzy of life to spend these few days looking at this kind of material and practicing and developing a relationship with it. This is the start of refining one's life. But for most of us, this is a part-time activity. It isn't what we're doing most of the time. And if you say, well, I don't know how to do that most of the time. In order to be able to do that most of the time, we have to take this very, very seriously indeed and realize that trying to achieve fame, status, respect, wealth, et cetera, are secondary concerns. And that is the point of these themes that I've just been going over right now, is to get us to the point that we actually appreciate that those are the secondary concerns and the quality with which we experience our life is the primary concern. And that is not how we generally approach our lives. So that's one piece of groundwork. It's very important. It clarifies motivation, gives us energy for the practice. Second bit of groundwork is creating the emotional / mental basis so that our efforts in practice can be effective. You might say it's like just use a sports analogy. Grass courts in tennis are rolled, they're watered and rolled, and they're properly prepared so that people can actually play on them. And the ball doesn't bounce at weird angles all over the place and things like that. So every meditation period, there are ways of starting it which calm us down and prepare us for the practice. Traditionally, one of those is to recall the tradition, the lineage through which the transmission comes, and basically cultivate an attitude of devotion, which brings about a certain calming. Ones that are standard in all the traditions of Buddhism are refuge, reminding oneself, what am I here for? Excuse me. I'm here. Refuge is about taking refuge in the natural emptiness, clarity, and spontaneity of our own mind. That's Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, emptiness, clarity, and spontaneous nature of experience. Not in anything out there, but in what our experience actually is. And why do we do this? In order to be able to help others. That's the essence, the expression of compassion. But that expression of compassion, in turn, you know, in order to help all beings become enlightened, well, in the world of our individual experience, what are all sentient beings? All sentient beings are nothing other than the totality of our own experience. So it's not only to come to know the empty, open nature of our experience, but to know that empty, open nature in every facet of our experience, nothing left out. So that's why we do the prayers of refuge and awakening mind at the beginning. And to help along, we also do the four immeasurables, which again reinforces those. And that way we create a basis for practice. Now, we're going to go to practice very shortly. I'm running a little bit over. What I want you to do in this practice period is to take these four ideas, precious human birth, death and impermanence, karma, and shortcomings of samsara. I want you to think about them. And think about them in very simple ways. Why am I actually practicing? Why am I here? What am I really doing? Of course, this is a little risky. It may be the end or in the middle of the meditation period, all of you get up and just leave. Well, whoever's here will work with that. But just to really think about this. What am I doing here? Why am I here? And what do I want to get out of these few days together? What do I want to know? What do I want to be different? What is the relationship of what I'm doing here to what I call the rest of my life? What prevents me from living life without struggle, without any sort of struggle? These are all questions which are implicit in these contemplations, but rather than go through the traditional contemplations, I thought it might be helpful just to pose these questions. Now, when you pose these questions, it's probably not going to be terribly comfortable. Stuff's going to come up. You may just find there's some uncomfortable feelings. So don't be too concerned with working out answers to the questions. That's not what I'm concerned with here. When you ask, what am I actually doing here? You may find, I don't know. Okay, then what I suggest is you just use your meditation practice to be in that experience of not knowing. Of course, as I said, there's not a lot of fun, but it's very important. Okay, and you just let yourself be there, and you may be surprised what happens. And when I say be there, there are going to be physical sensations, there are going to be emotions which come up, there are going to be stories which come up. First, practice being there, but the physical sensations. When you can stay with all the physical sensations, then include the emotional sensations. When you can include both the physical and the emotional, then include the stories, not as facts. That's important. And you make, I said, wow, there's just a whole bunch here. What do I want to be different at the end of this? What do I want to get out of this, these few days? And again, the answer is, gee, I just thought I was coming to practice. I don't know what I want to get out of this. It's very, very important for you to be active agents in your practice, not just receiving. But what does this mean to you? Many years ago, I was giving a talk to a congregation in San Diego on an Episcopal church on the Buddhist contemplative tradition. And I really didn't know what to talk about. So I made what in retrospect was the disastrous mistake of standing up in front of this congregation of 80 people and said, okay, all of you came here for a reason. You want to know something. What do you want to know? And there was absolutely dead silence. And after 5 minutes, which is a very long time to stand up in front of a group and say nothing, I gave up and just started talking because nobody was going to ask a question. Nobody was looking to be an active agent. They were just there to absorb. It's not good enough. What do you want to be different? Because I want you to think about that and then make sure that you take a step in that direction over these few days. And you can tell me in the interviews, what you want to be different at the end of this. Michelle,
can you run through the list of four things again?
Four questions or the four?
Yeah, death and impermanence.
Yeah, they're all in here. Should read the book sometime. Precious human birth, that is the opportunity to practice, is rare. death and impermanence, the working of karma, and shortcomings of samsara is how it's usually phrased. It just means the difficulty of living in reactive emotions or emotional reactions. And you'll find all of that on page 9. This book. How many of you have the Great Path of Awakening? Yeah.
Did you bring copies to sell?
No, I didn't, of course not. I'm terrible about that kind of thing. Sorry. Maybe. Pardon? Well, no, it's just the earlier edition. Yeah. Possibly can get Amazon. We're Wednesday today. Can Amazon get them by Friday? That one page? I'm sorry I didn't put that in the reading list. Yeah, that would be easy to do. Can you, want to take care of that? Okay. It's just actually the 2 pages. It's fine. But basically, I don't really want you to think about those things. What I want you to do is to think about, why am I here? What do I want to get out of being here? What is the place of this in my life? If you want to go further with that, you know, how seriously am I going to take this? Leslie. Could we get the microphones? So these are.
Are you calling these the preliminary practices?
Hmm. Groundwork.
Groundwork.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not preliminary practices in the way that, like, I mean, you said Nundro, and I think of it as something else.
Well, we have the ordinary groundwork, and then we have the special groundwork. What you're referring to is the special groundwork. You're talking about prostrations and Vajrasattva and all that stuff. Yeah. See, this is where the confusion is. If you do these really solidly, the ones I'm talking about, then you'll find that the special groundwork, which is very specifically aimed at preparing someone to do Mahamudra meditation, that'll become very easy. The ordinary foundations or the general foundations or general groundwork is for all aspects of Dharma practice. That's why it's important. And when you, if you're studying, what text are you studying with Arlene?
Wild Awakening.
Wild Awakening? Oh, okay. Yeah, and he'll talk about these because these are the ones you do first. And then you do the special groundwork. And then if you want, you can do the very special groundwork. And then we can do the very, very special groundwork. In the end, it's all groundwork. Now, I'm just being a little facetious, but there are sequences. I mean, and you have these, and then you have the groundwork for the Mahamudra practice, which is the ones you're talking about. Then you have, there's another set which are for Dzogchen, and then within that, there's another set for Trekchu and Tugo, and then there's very special preparations for certain kinds of practices and so forth. So, but the irony is, the wonderful irony, is the more thoroughly you do the ones that I'm talking about, you really take, okay, why am I doing this? What do I want to get out of this? You get really, really clear about this. You will not have any problem in your practice after that. What people do is this person said to do this, or this person said to do this, so I'll just do this. And they don't really take it in, why am I doing this? And that's the most important question. Why am I doing this? Because everything that you're told to do is what other people have found have worked for them. There's no guarantee it's going to work for you. You've got to figure out why are you doing this? What is important to you? And then find out how to address what is really, really important to you. Okay? Michelle?
What should Atisha have done in the tent?
Ask Green Tara. Yeah. You can translate this into life's circumstances, or circumstances in our everyday lives. How many times have we seen behaviors that we have been judgmental about, the real import of which we did not appreciate and rejected them? Right? Often to our misfortune. Okay, I mean, that's one of the messages in that story, that things arise and we cannot see what they actually are because of our own confusion. And so we reject them. So it's not about what Atisha should have done. It's about what do you do in similar circumstances. Okay, it's very, very important. This last couple of points that have come up here. This is not about them. This is about you. And so everything that I say, you know, does this make sense to you? And if it doesn't, then, you know, just as Alex was doing, ask about it. Because if it doesn't make sense to you, then you're not going to get anything out of it. And I can't guarantee that it's going to make sense. I'll do my best, do the best job that I can, but this is really up to you for it to be relevant and make sense and something you can actually use in your practice. So that's your responsibility here. Okay? So one question, a quick question, because now we're definitely over.
About this question, so do you think it's good for us to go actually on each question that you raised? Or if I think I know, then just go to the one that is more problematic for me, or just start all of them?
Spend a little time with each of them. You may say, okay, why am I here? Well, I mean, what did people say yesterday? I'm here to practice. Okay. Well, there's a technique you can use here called the five whys. Okay. Why am I here? I'm here to practice. Why do I practice? Because I want to be awake. Why do I want to be awake? And by the time you ask that why five times, you're getting down to something pretty solid. You follow? Okay. So, even just reviewing, just sitting, okay, this is the reason, then sit with that and think, is this the reason? And let yourself feel it. Because if it is the reason, whenever you let yourself feel it, then you're clear about your practice and then you just don't have any problems. So reconnecting with that reason, if it's clear in you, is a very good thing to do itself. Okay? All right. We've run a little bit over. I tried to end at 10:15. It's 10:23. Who's on Han? Chuck, okay.
All rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.